You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Grant, and welcome to Community Connections. I'm Alan Collier, and it's my pleasure to be with you for the next actual 3 hours. We've got our legal hour, the first hour, then the second hour we have Beck from Bridge Builders coming in to tell us about a fund run that they're organising to get some well-earned dollars that they need. And then, of course, between 2 and 3, we've got Choice Tunes. I've got the person coming in at 2 o'clock, pardon me, and I've got their songs all lined up. And just a quick reminder that if you miss some of these Choice Tunes, if you go to our website, look on the first page comes up, click on the left-hand side podcast, then go up to, and you'll get another screen that's got Choice Tunes. Click on that, and one of the people that are with me this afternoon, in fact, in a couple of gifs, is Con, and he did his, and his is up there, and he's got about 190 hits. So he'd love to get a few more. He wants to be the leader, but there are heaps of them up there. Anyway, it's been the legal hour. We have Hutchinson Legal with us. We have Con and Belinda. Welcome.
G'day, Alan. Great to be here.
Hi, Alan. Great to be here.
Terrific. Now, Con, you're going well on the podcast, so...
It was a pleasure to do it, and we've had other guests from Hutchinson Legal, and...
And you just want to beat them?
I just want to have more downloads than them, and I'm satisfied with that.
I'm not touching that. Con, somebody... Grant. Is Grant listening, do you know?
I hope he is, but...
Grant... Guy told me I should tell you this story. You're always the one that likes the sick jokes. Guy standing down in the main street of Lilydale at the ATM. He's standing on one foot. He's trying to mess around getting man the ATM. And the guy behind him waits for a little while and he taps him on the shoulder. What's going on, mate? He said, and why are you on one leg? He said, I'm checking my balance. Boom, boom.
Boom, boom.
Now, that's about as good as one of Grant's. But anyway, Con and Belinda, we had a question... that we sent you away with to do some homework. A guy had his car knocked off, didn't think he'd ever see it again, went out, and I believe in the terms of his insurance policy, they've got 10 days to find the car. When it got to about 6 or 7 days, he didn't believe the car would come back, so he went out and bought another car. And then all of a sudden, the insurance company find this car, said, well, we'll do anything that needs to it. It's yours. Now, he wants to know where legally he stands, because... he doesn't need two cars. He's already bought one car. Maybe a bit silly buying one that quick, but Belinda, I believe you're going to tell us what happens in that case.
Yes. So if a vehicle is stolen and the insurer was to pay him out, then the vehicle, even if it's recovered, becomes the property of the insurer. However, in this situation, the insurer hasn't paid him out yet and they've found the vehicle in the time of the 10-day estimate. So... what would happen now is the insurance would be responsible to fix any damages to the vehicle. If the vehicle has been ridden off, then he would still get paid out. But if the vehicle is repairable, they would repair the vehicle and give it back to him. It would still be his property. So he won't be legally entitled to ask for a payout instead of recovering
the car. He'd still have to pay the excess on the claim
for
getting the car repaired, the one that was stolen.
So it really, I guess... what we're saying here is that he shouldn't have bought the car before the 10 days, the new car before the 10 days, should he?
Well, if he's stuck with that contract, yeah, he won't be able to get out of that contract. He'll have to buy the second car.
He already took control of that car within 2 days.
Yep.
So I guess the warning is if your car does get stolen, check your policy if it's got that 10... Are they all 10 days... cooling off, or not cooling off, but 10 days, do you know?
Oh, I don't know.
Not all insurers are different. So not all insurers have the same policy, the 10 days. Some have 30 days and some have no cooling off period.
30 days is a long while, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and I guess the other way you could get around that, if your insurance policy covered the fact that for a hire car until the car came back.
Yeah, a lot of insurers offers that optional extra.
Yep.
But you've got to make sure you select that option for a hire car.
And it's no good trying to rewrite the policy after something's gone wrong, is it?
Yeah, a bit late.
Yeah, a bit late. All right, we'll take a quick break. I know Belinda and Colin have got a bit to talk to us about. We've also got a few questions for them as well. So we shall be back very soon.
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to Community Connections to the Legal Hour. And we should make, I did say they're both from Hutchison Legal, but Con is from Hutchison Legal, and Belinda is from a company called Your Lawyer. What a way to, what a name. How long did it take to come up with a name?
Oh, look, I'll congratulate or blame Grant for that. We thought it was catchy.
All right. Oh, it is too. Belinda, you want to talk about personal injury claims. Is that your specialty?
Yes. So yeah. I do all sorts of personal injury claims, including work cover, TSC, public liability, so slips and falls, medical negligence. And now we're starting to do a lot of historical abuse claims and bullying cases, which all falls under personal injury. With historical abuse claims, we're seeing a trend in these. Previously, there was a statute of limitations that said that you had to, from 6 years from the date of injury or 12 years from the date of the abuse, you had to bring a court action. And now, since 2015, they got rid of that. So now you can bring forward a case that's 30 years or 40 years old.
And we're seeing a few of those now, aren't we?
We're seeing quite a lot of them, yep. There's been a lot of media coverage regarding historical abuse as well, so it's made a lot of people come forward. And the other trend we're seeing are bullying cases. So there's new anti-bullying legislation, and one of the parts of the legislation was Brodie's Law, which that commenced back in 2011, but has had a lot of emphasis in recent days, which meant that serious bullying is a crime punishable by up to 10 years, and that includes for people underage that have conducted the bullying, so teenagers.
Underage,
yep. And so there's a lot of bullying case coming forward, and the personal injury that comes from that is lack of supervision, lack of care, and just the ability to ensure that when you send your child to school that they're in a safe environment.
Right. Just go back amongst the ones you mentioned, you were talking about medical. What was that one?
Medical negligence. So
right. I'm just curious, how do you prove that?
Well, it has to be, we would get an expert report, and another expert would have to say that in the situation of the person that's been negligent, so the doctor or surgeon that's been negligent, in their situation, they would have done things differently. So that's the test, that a reasonable practitioner would have conducted things differently, whether it's used different surgical equipment or conduct a different sort of treatment or do further investigations that the GP or the doctor might not have done. So it's lack of treatment and delay in treatment.
So all the treatments, all the cases you talk about, such as bullying and all those sorts of things, we're only talking civil here, aren't we? Like, it's not a case of, it's a case of me suing Con because I think he did the wrong thing to me rather than a jail sentence or anything like that. You're not prosecuting people, are you?
Well, it's interesting you say that because in work cover claims, it used to be that you'd go through work cover and you'd get paid out or you'd go through a common law claim. But now WorkSafe is cracking down on employers. So if they've done something that's caused you to be seriously injured, they can prosecute the employer directly and they can be looking at jail time, including manslaughter charges as well, if they've done something that's grossly negligent that's led to someone either dying or sustaining a serious injury.
Belinda, also with this, I just can't quite work out how to put this, but I notice, and I don't want to get into religion and that, we're not here to do that, but I notice on particularly one of the churches that if you signed up to their redress, you took some money and that was it. But by the sound of things, they're reopening some of those too, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. We are seeing a lot of those cases. And if you're referring to the National Redress Scheme, the compensation in that is limited. So it's limited to up to $150,000, whereas personal injury, the limit is much higher. So we don't recommend going down that path without first consulting with a lawyer.
Yep. Con, you were saying something interesting about the payouts for personal injury.
Yes. Well, one of my main practice areas is bankruptcy.
Yep.
And an interaction here with personal injury compensation is bankruptcy is that a person's right to make a claim for compensation for personal injury or wrong done to them, or if it's a personal injury to a family member because under the Victims of Crime Assistance, which your lawyer handles, the family members can be entitled to monies if somebody's killed in a crime, which is obviously a crime, depending on how it's done. But that money is protected in bankruptcy. So the right to claim the money, as well as if you recover that money for personal injury to yourself or to a family member, that's protected money under the Bankruptcy Act. And what's also important is to keep records of how you use that money, because if you buy an asset, a car, a house, any valuable asset, using that compensation money, if it's the whole or substantially the whole, so it might be 90% or 85%, if that asset that you've bought with the compensation money is also protected in bankruptcy. So it's very important to keep records of receiving that money, that it came from a personal injury claim, and that you've used it to buy that asset. If that money was used to, say, pay 50% of an asset, the bankruptcy trustee could grab that asset but have to refund you the 50% that was used from the compensation money. So it's quite important to understand that, even though you might have other financial pressures, a creditor makes you bankrupt or you just go bankrupt yourself, these rights for claiming the personal injury money is protected.
Terrific. Look, I've got another question for Belinda, but I'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Worries and troubles come around. Yes, I don't look for no worries, people. Worries and troubles come around. The world keep on turning. I got to keep my feet on the ground. Nobody saw me crying. Nobody knows the way I feel. Nobody saw me crying. Nobody knows the way I feel. Yeah, the way I love the woman, it's bound to get me killed.
London East, and you're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Grant, I guarantee you didn't hear that joke. Otherwise, I think you'd have been on the phone by now telling us how bad it was. But anyway, Con will tell it when we get back. Belinda, you were talking about claims, and we were talking about bullying. All right, so so obviously you're working for a client, for someone who's been bullied. Are we talking about young people as well, like children?
Yes, so most of the cases do come from children, so in primary schools and the bullying that's happening there.
So my little Johnny or Fred or whoever is being bullied, so I come to you. So who are you going to sue and who pays? Because am I as a parent or say, some come on and say, my little Johnny's been bullied by Con's little friend, and so I come to you and say, well, what are you going to do about it? So you, after a lot of negotiation or whatever, you decide to sue Con. So Con says, well, kid's only nine. So what happens then?
Well, we would be suing the school, but the school would have an insurance, and the insurance would likely add the parent. So if it's been a problem child and someone had, the principal had gone to Con multiple occasions and said your child's causing disruption and the parent didn't.
Son, no.
But the parents do tend to get added into the case as a second defendant or a third party by the insurance company. So we would be going after the school, and because they have the first responsibility to make sure the students are safe and kept in a safe environment.
All right, I'm going to play the devil advocate. My little Johnny's perfect. Con's little Fred is perfect at school, but on the way home from school and the weekends, he gives my little Johnny hell. Who do you go after then?
Out of the school, yeah, and it's not on a school bus taking them home or in that sort of situation, it's completely out of the school, out of school hours, then we would be suing the parent.
Right. I just want to know whether at some stage the parents are held responsible.
Yep.
All of a sudden, I'm going to be ringing my insurance broker saying, can I get insurance for my nine-year-old for their behaviour? I don't know if there's such a thing. I'll call my broker.
You go call your solicitor, he'll tell you.
Yeah.
Now, Con, you want to expand a bit on bankruptcy?
Well, yeah, speaking about bankruptcy generally, it's obviously the challenges financially are coming from all sides at the moment. People are experiencing the higher interest rates, so the mortgage repayments going up. Business loans will be higher interest as well, much higher than the mortgage rates.
Yep.
You've got energy prices going up, gas prices going up.
And they're
going
to get worse.
We've been officially told by our government they're going up and up, right?
Yep.
So, you know, don't believe anything you were told before. Believe that. But there's also the ATO, the tax office, has been very active now going after company directors for unpaid company taxes because they went really soft during the COVID pandemic years. A lot of financial assistance was provided. But now the tax office is saying time's up and they're issuing what's called director penalty notices. It's very important to get advice about those. There's very limited time to act on them. But it's important that company directors with company debts understand that they become personal debts and they need to act on them immediately, get advice from a lawyer or an insolvency practitioner, a registered one. There's a lot of unregulated ones out there. Stay away from them. They are dangerous. They'll tell you things to do which are just wrong and will cost you in the long run.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of pressure, but despite all those pressures, at the moment, the statistics say that the bankruptcies are just low, low, low. There's not that many people going bankrupt at the moment. But I think those stats will go back to normal in the next, say, 12 to 24 months, given all of these pressures. There's got to be a breaking point, unfortunately, and with all those pressures.
Con, we had a very famous case, and I'm not going to mention names, but I think everyone will know it. In Western Australia, quite a lot of years ago, where a high flyer went completely.
I call him the poster boy of bankruptcy.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, yeah. Right. I'll tell you why. Like, you keep going.
You can tell me that in a minute. And from what I can remember, and I'm going to ask if this was true, when the company was flowing along all right and there was plenty of money, they diverted assets out of the company. And then when when the whole thing went broke, I had a feeling it was something about if you transferred assets while the business was going well and at least 6 months before the company went broke, that they were untouchable. Is that true?
There's a lot of different rules around company assets being transferred out as well as personal assets and the time limits or the time, what's called relation back period. So how far back can you go in the history to try and undo some past transactions? There's been new laws in the Corporations Act, more recent laws called what's called creditor defeating dispositions. And
that sounds like a mouthful. What was
yeah,
it?
That's Predator? Right. Predator defeating dispositions. There you go. Basically stealing the company's money and giving it to other people.
Right.
When there's no, there's also what's called unreasonable director related transactions. So basically money just going straight out of an account to the director's spouse or to a relative.
Or mother.
Or mother. Or and there's also other what's called preference payments to creditors. They could be related creditors or unrelated creditors. The six-month period you referred to is usually about unrelated creditors, payments made before a company goes into insolvency. So there are a whole series of rules and different time periods and... usually, if you're trying to move assets, you've got to try and do it when there's no problems, no debt problems. But even that's not 100% guarantee because there are laws that say if it was done to keep the assets out of the hands of creditors, so in a personal bankruptcy situation, if it's done to defeat creditors, it doesn't matter that you were... solvent at the time, it matters what you did next. So there was a case where a guy transferred his house to his wife.
Yep.
He had no debt problems. 2 weeks later, he signed a contract and gave a personal guarantee for his business, which potentially made him liable for the $7 million.
Yep.
He didn't immediately... He signed those contracts, and it wasn't until maybe 5 or more years later that he actually was sued for the $7 million. But because he had done it 2 weeks after he'd transferred his house, the trustee was successful in getting the house transferred back to him or to the trustee because it was done with the purpose to defeat a future creditor that he had in mind. There's no guarantee. And the other problem with move your assets while you're solvent, there's no protection from family law. They can still go after...
Well, family law doesn't have much...
Wherever you think it's hidden, family law will try and grab it back.
All right, we'll just take another quick break and we'll be back with more.
Yarra Valley FM acknowledges the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri people, as the custodians of this land we broadcast from. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley, where it's 16 minutes to one. Time goes really quick when I got these people in, and we've hit the top 29 degrees, so I think we'll probably go over that. Yes, there was something I was going to ask you that I was going to get you to do when you go away, but we will take this one now. I still have something else for you to do. What can a lawyer do and what can't a lawyer do? Now, you may want to think about this, or you may want to even take it away. I would have thought one of the things that you can't do is sit on a jury, because I would suggest you know too much and they don't want Mr. and Mrs. Average on a jury. Suppose I came to you and said to you, I've done something pretty stupid here. I've done such and such, and I want to plead guilty because I did it. As can a lawyer say, oh, no, don't do that. No, I can get you off this. So who are you actually working for? Because I thought you're supposed to be working for the courts, and I can tell by the look on your face this is going to go somewhere. Or are you working for me? And can you give me advice that's probably contrary to what should happen in a court case?
Well, that raises a lot of interesting issues there.
Do you want to take it away?
I can give some response here. Your duty as a lawyer, your duty to the court is higher than your duty to the client.
Right.
So what that then means in practical terms, if you have a client who says, yes, I committed this crime and the police have charged me, but I want to plead not guilty, you can't represent to the court, my client is innocent, when the client's already told you they did it. So your duty to the court, you can't mislead a court, you can't put evidence to the court or make submissions to a court which you know are just not correct. So so people always say, how can you act for somebody who's pleading guilty? And you go, oh, well, that's people say, if you know they've done it. Now, unless the client's told me they've done it, I don't know that they've done it. I'm not the judge and I'm not the jury.
All right, so let's just take one step back. Yep. So I walk into you, yes, and I say I've committed whatever crime, and yes, I know I did it. So yes, I want to plead guilty.
Mm.
Would you then have to say to the client, well, I can't act for you anymore because I know you're guilty, but I think I could get you off?
Are you talking before they've been charged or after charged?
No, someone's been charged.
They've been charged,
And they've come, and I've come to you and I've said to you, Con, I've done X.
Well, if you've already made the statement to police saying you did it, it's a bit late to come and get the advice.
But then that does happen, because there's a case at the moment where he's pleaded guilty and now he's turned, before he could get sentenced,
yes,
he's turned around and changed his mind and said, no, I didn't do it.
Yes, so that may be a problem for the lawyers. It depends what the lawyer knows, I suppose. So,
I'm asking you, if I told you I've done it, does that mean you'd say to me, Alan, I'm sorry, you need to go and find another solicitor?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I can't say to the court you haven't done it when you've told me you've done it.
Right.
Yeah, so that's. I can't say to the court my client's innocent when my client already told me that they're guilty.
So therefore,
So I'd say to the client, I don't want to know. All I want to know is, in criminal matters, it's up to the prosecution, the police, to prove their case.
Yeah.
And prove it what's called beyond reasonable doubt. So it's not a 50-50 thing. It's 95% definitely this happened and there's no doubt about it, or there's no reasonable doubt is what they say. Right. So it's up to the police to prove it.
Yep.
The client, the alleged offender, can maintain their right to silence and not give evidence, not make a statement. It's about whether the proof is enough to say there's really no other reasonable explanation for what happened other than this person did it.
All right, so do you want to give that some thought for whoever comes in next time? What else can you not do?
Yeah, well, you were right about the juries. Lawyers can't be on juries. It seems amateur academics can't be on juries now with the Brittany Higgins and the Bruce Lerman.
Now, I'd love to talk about that case, but I've got to be extremely careful, so I think we'd better...
Well, we're not allowed to because the judge said don't talk about it.
Yeah.
But just the problem that happened with the jury member there taking in an academic paper aborted the whole trial, and that's very traumatic for everyone involved.
All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Just a quick mention too, we are moving to Healesville over Christmas sometime around there, and we are running a fundraising appeal at the moment. So if you'd like to go to our website, which is www.yarravalleyfm.org.au, there's a spot there where you could donate. Or if you're going past the station, I had a couple of people call in last Sunday and just drop off some money. It would be really terrific. Righto, so someone's getting ready to take down what we want to know. All right, we've had a question about bail. Now, I know we've discussed bail two or three times is what the judge has got to take into account. But the question this time, the person who rang knows somebody that's on bail for the fourth time. So they committed a crime, they're on bail, they commit another crime while they're on bail, they got bail again, it's happened a third time, and now they're on bail for the fourth time. We want to know, first of all, how can people keep getting bail? Because if you've broken bail in the first time, you're not going to keep it in the second, third and fourth. And there must be some way where you could look up and tell us what's the person who's got them, not necessarily the person who they are, but what's the most a person's been given bail. We're not talking about someone who had bail 20 years ago and then they come up and they get bail 10 years later and, you know, that. We're talking about people who are on bail, commit a crime, still get bail, commit another crime. This guy claims he knows someone that's had it four times and he just said, well, A, how can they keep getting it so often? And B, how they would like to know who has got the most amount of bail, most amount of times, not money, the most amount of time.
That seems like a challenging question, which I'm going to ask Phil Hayes of our office, our criminal lawyer. I'm going to ask him.
And hopefully next time he'll send along the person who's got the answer.
Well, whoever comes, he'll be the one giving them the answer.
Righto. Now, we've only got a few minutes left. Data breaches. We've been hearing about them everywhere. Like it's like a bucket with about a million holes in it. They're out everywhere. I guess what can a person do? I mean, some of these organisations, you have to give them so much information. I still can't see why a phone company has to have a passport or that. Once you've proved who you are, surely that can all be deleted. But it obviously isn't. Here we are. People have had them 10 years ago and they've still been. Medicare is probably just as bad, is probably worse because you're adding to, you know, what the claims you've had. What can people do about it?
Well, you just have to have a good security system. Don't use passwords that are generic in nature. Don't use your name and passwords, your date of birth, things that can be guessed by people.
Yeah, but that's... That it's not what you've done, it's what these organisations have done.
All of a sudden... It's about changing everything, unfortunately, and using what's called multi-factor authentication, which is getting an SMS code to your mobile phone, because it's not even safe to get a code to an email anymore. It's usually email accounts are compromised. So you need some other way of verifying that it's you doing the transaction. And I think eventually, one of the things they're trying to centralise is, you know, using MyGovID for government services and things.
But then someone will hack that.
Well, yeah, look, there's no... I see the data security. It's like your house. You just hope that nobody's really interested in your house.
Because, is that what you're going
because
for?
You can lock the windows and you can lock the doors, but if somebody wants to smash their way in... They can, and unless you put, you know, prison bars around the whole place, they're going to get in, and that's what we're finding.
All right. So it's really, it's more these big organisations that I've just got someone online for the next interview. It's more for them to protect themselves better, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. There are you can only do so much, but you've got to be able to show as an organisation that you've implemented as much data security as you can, but nothing's perfect. And as we've seen, even the federal police have had data breaches. Yeah. The government's constantly under attack. The ATO is constantly under attack. It's just going on all the time. And there are some, I think Belinda mentioned to me before, there are some class actions going on.
Is it?
And about these data breaches, but ultimately in the end, it's a bit hard. You've got to sort of prove that your identity was stolen and reused somewhere else, and then you suffered some loss from that activity of the criminal. So it's not immediately apparent that your data, even though it's leaked out there, you're just hoping it's a tiny fish in a massive ocean. And hopefully you're not the unlucky one that has their identity.
But then there's about 500,000 that have been unlucky, isn't there?
Well, I don't know that there's that many. The data's out there.
Yeah.
But I don't know how many have actually been used. So you'll see some stories of people that say, oh, a credit card was applied for in my name or a personal loan was applied for
in my name. Oh, I see. Yep.
And so you can get credit reports. There's a number of places, which is, what's it called? Equifax is one of them, and there's a couple of others. You can get a credit report so you can see if new inquiries have been made on your credit for credit.
So really you can't do much about the original breach.
No.
It's mainly trying to protect yourself that it's not, that nothing else is being done from it.
Or you can try and join the class action if you know, but I don't know how you prove what damage you've suffered. If your identity details are out there but no one uses them, you haven't really lost anything
lost
yet.
Lost anything. Yeah, that's a good point.
So I'm not sure what you get back for that, other than the fear and panic. Maybe it's a personal injury claim if you have psychological damage from knowing that your data is out there.
Potentially, yes. It just depends on the damage that you've sustained as a result of the breach.
Because you'd have to be able to prove that you had...
That's right.
...had done something. Look, unfortunately, it's a fascinating hour. It really is. But unfortunately, the hour is just about gone. It goes extremely quickly. So we've got one more show of the legal hour between now and Christmas. We won't be here. Yes, we'll be here in December. We won't be here in January. We'll be back in February. So thank you, Con and Belinda, for coming in. We do all appreciate the time that you give us. And there will be a podcast go up on our website within the next few days, all about what we talked about today. So if you miss any part of it, feel free to log on. And thank you very much, Con and Belinda, for coming in.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much.